Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Have you ever wondered what your relationship to food has to do with sex? Or why pleasure is so complicated for us culturally? Dawn Sarah is here to talk to us today, and she is a therapeutic sex and relationship coach specializing in pleasure, body trust, and boundaries. She is currently completing her Master of Counseling degree and will soon be opening a therapeutic private practice in British Columbia, specializing in trauma, body, and relationships specifically for people in bigger bodies. Dawn believes that we heal in relationship, and her work is about creating space where people can explore the kind of healing they're dreaming of without having to do it alone. Rooted in practices of playfulness, curiosity, empathy, and imperfection. Dawn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to get to chat with you today.
I'm so excited. So, Dawn, I've known about your work and referred to you often for the past several years. And when I was thinking about this topic today, sex, which even I notice like I'm even tensing up when I say it. I'm like, am I allowed to say that? Yeah. I just, you know, was walking around with it. And then I had it. I was like, it's Dawn. I've been reading your blog for so long. I love it so much. Anyway, thank you for the work that you do there. So your work helps people heal their relationship with their body and food through pleasure. Why is pleasure so complicated for us culturally?
Ooh, that is a big, important question. There's a lot of reasons for why pleasure is so complicated for us. Some of it goes back to religious ideals around the body being a source of sin or dirtiness. Some of it is really around who gets to take up space in our world and who is expected to shrink or people please. And the thing about pleasure is that it really requires being seen. It requires us to be present in our lives. It requires us to believe we're worthy of saying, I want, I need, I deserve. So there's worthiness, there's boundaries. And for a lot of us, those things are really hard to do. To say, see me in this vulnerable place of presence so that I can actually enjoy my body. And whether it's because of trauma or patriarchy or diet culture, all the other things that are at play in our lives, that is a pretty radical thing to take up space in our lives and say, I want, and to believe that you deserve it. And to let other people then respond to that can be really, really scary, especially if we've experienced people shaming us or telling us we're too much, we want too much, we're too needy to be more quiet. So pleasure really bumps up against all of these really complicated messages. And so it takes a long time of practicing very deliberately for a lot of us to get closer to a relationship with pleasure.
And what does our relationship with food have to do with sex?
Yes. I love this. I kind of stumbled on this through my work, where I originally was doing sex education for adults and working in the field of sexuality. And because of my own journey with my body and with disordered eating, started also getting training around things related to the body and got introduced to like eating disorder treatments and body trust. And I started noticing that a lot of the ways that people thought about and restricted, measured, counted, and performed with food really aligned with a lot of the same ways that people were doing that when it came to sex. So, you know, if we believe we're only allowed to have so much before it's too much, often people were kind of approaching sex in a similar way of, is it taking too long? Am I allowed to ask for this? Similarly, you know, people being able to give themselves permission to just Maybe I want cake for lunch. Maybe that's my appetizer. You know, that can be really frightening for a lot of us, just like saying we'd like to use a toy in the bedroom, or we'd like to try something maybe kind of playful or kinky, can feel really confronting because then people see us in that. So it's been really interesting kind of teasing these things out. And a big part of it also is because if we're really eating from a place that's really present and body-centered, where I really think, like, what would feel really nourishing for me right now? That presence, that's also what's required for us to have, you know, that really beautiful, pleasure-filled, embodied kind of sex of, in this moment right now, does this touch feel good? And do I feel worthy of asking for something different, even if it might make the person that I'm with, if there's others there, feel a little bit surprised or disappointed or unsure? We've got to navigate all of those, you know, relational situations. So a lot of us grew up with messages around restricting food, controlling our body, the same when it comes to sex. You know, there's all kinds of cultural messages about what sex is too much, too soon, whether it makes us good or bad. And so we just have so many conflicting messages. It's really hard for us to arrive in a place where we're doing things on our terms through and from our body versus based on what everything outside of us is telling us what to do.
Several years ago, I was at a International Eating Disorder Conference, and there happened to be a keynote speaker there that was a well-known sex journalist. And it was interesting because of some of the feedback that I got from my colleagues. It's like, what is she doing here? Why are we, what does this talk have to do with anything? We're in an eating disorder conference. I totally got that, why that speaker was there, but it was confusing for people.
Yeah, there's a real self-objectification that happens for us that we're taught, right? We are taught to self-objectify, to think about how others are viewing us, and then to behave based on what we think others see. And we do this around food. You know, when we sit down at a restaurant, we think about what everyone else at the table is ordering and what they'll think of us before we make our choice often. Right? Or the comments we'll get from our family. So that is us self-objectifying. We're not experiencing what we want in the moment. We're thinking about how others will view us and then making decisions. And we do so much the same with sex. Do I look good in this position? What are they thinking? Am I taking too long? How will they feel if I ask for XYZ rather than, you know, being in your body and thinking, ooh, this is good, or I'd like a little more of this or less of this, and just being with the experience. So that self-objectification piece comes in so heavily, both around food and also sex.
Yeah. And it's just so interesting to see how out of balance things can become if you try to take pleasure out of the equation.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, when we are, you know, it's one of the things that I really talk about when it comes to a pleasure practice is that my hope is that as we deepen in our pleasure practice, we're moving closer to agency and autonomy. Do I really think that I have a choice, and can I freely make that choice based on what I need? And so often the ways we're taught to think about food and exercise are based on external sources, people other than us telling us, here's what you should be doing with your meal plan. Here's the nutrients that are good and bad. Here's the things that you should be doing to be clean or whole or whatever it is. And we get very similar messages around sex, that we should be able to achieve orgasm from a very particular type of action. We shouldn't need whatever it is to help us get to a place of stimulation or orgasm, that we should sound sexy at all times, that we shouldn't need to ask for something to be different because it might kill the mood. So we've got all these external messages coming in from media, from movies. The other thing that's really interesting is, you know, we see people eating all the time. And so we see lots of different ways of eating. Some of them might be really unhealthy. Some of them might be really joyous. But when it comes to sex, we never really get a chance to see that in action.
Oh, right? Never thought about it. Because, of course, food is such a consistent relationship. That's something we're doing all throughout the day.
The time.
You're right. We don't see sex.
No. Right. So the only messages that we get about what sex should look like is based off of something that's entirely made for entertainment, right? Whether it's television, movies, pornography, romance novels, all of those things are specifically created to sell and to entertain. Same with magazines. So we're learning what sex should look like from these very performative models that are about profit and salaciousness rather than the actual lived experience. And so that does complicate sex a little bit more. But still, whether it's food or sex, so much of how we operate is based on what others tell us we should be doing rather than discovering what works for us on our own.
Oh, I love that. And it really, for me, brings to full circle this thing I'm used to saying about food, which is, you know, the control model, which would be a diet versus the trust model. But I now see all the overlap.
Absolutely.
All the overlap.
Yes. 100%.
So when you say body trust, that's what you mean.
Exactly. Yes. Can I trust what I need in the moment? Can I trust that it's good and right because that's what would make me feel good? Or am I thinking based on the Cosmo quiz or based on what my friends said, right, that this is how it should be going? Or even a partner, you know, maybe a partner has a very particular expectation because, again, they probably also learned about sex from, you know, pornography and movies and their friends telling stories for entertainment and things like that. And so we're trying to navigate all of these things. So it's not our fault that it's difficult to arrive. It's not our fault that food feels complicated, that bodies feel complicated, that sex feels complicated. But it is our opportunity to really get to start changing those stories and to find some power in it. What does this mean for me, even if it looks like nobody else?
Nice. And even that awareness, the awareness of what you're speaking of, especially as it relates to sex, is like healing in and of itself. Dawn, one of the first blogs that I read of yours is something I had never thought of, and I've just never seen it as well done. You had this blog that said, "Your pleasure matters, but safety has," all in capital letters, "has to come first."
Yeah.
Why is safety such an important preliminary piece here?
Ooh, yes. This is such an important question. So the first thing I like to tell people is we can never achieve total safety. That's that's an important thing for us all to hold. It's one of the complicated truths of being a mammal on this living planet. You know, we are not guaranteed total safety at any point in time. So what we're looking for is enough safety. And specifically, what's really important for us to keep in mind is that our bodies are wired for survival first and foremost. So we are the result of all kinds of complicated systems. And the first thing that our body cares about is, can I survive this moment? Now, if a tiger is stalking me and gonna eat me, I don't care how good that food tastes or if that flower is pretty. I need to get away from that tiger. I need to not be eaten because if I smell the flower, then I might die. Let's not do that. So our systems really are scanning the environment always for danger. And for some of us who have had trauma or who exist in a body that experiences ongoing oppression, we can live in a body that is constantly aroused, right? In a nervous system that's constantly feeling like it's right on the edge of danger. And if you experience anxiety, especially, your system probably lives there most of the time. That's my experience. So when our bodies are like, am I going to survive this moment? It's pretty difficult to notice if something feels good. And so we really need to just be thinking about safety and what is safe enough and what helps my system, my body, to settle enough that it's not trying just to survive, but can actually arrive. So if I'm here and I find enough safety might look different for everybody. It might be those moments in the car when you're alone, getting ready to drive home. It might be in the bathroom where the kiddos can't reach you for 5 minutes. You know, it might be that you feel safe in a lot of different places and spaces, and it might be that you feel safe enough in very few. But once we kind of figure out where do I feel safe enough to really just be with myself, arrive for a few minutes. From there, we can start investigating what feels good for me. What do I like? Where is my yes? And we start being able to discern some of these other wonderful things that our body makes available to us. But survival always has to come first. And we notice the difference when we think about different situations. For instance, if I'm cooking dinner in the kitchen and my partner comes up and rubs my back without me knowing, right? I didn't see him come up. The way I experience that touch, it's going to be quite different than if I'm on a subway crowded with strangers and somebody starts rubbing my back that way, right? I'm going to have a very different physical response to those things. One probably feels pleasurable, connected. It might make me turn around and smile. The other is going to make me tense up and like really prepare for either fight or flight. And so just kind of thinking about our bodies in that way helps to give us an opportunity to choose circumstances where we have more options for pleasure.
Well, and I like in the blog too that the piece where you bring to light what does safety feel like for you. Yes. I hadn't even really thought about how no one else could define safety for us.
Mm-mm. No, absolutely not. It's so important for us to start asking those questions so that we understand, you know, what it means for us, because people might tell you should feel safe at home, right? Or assume, well, we feel safe at home. But, you know, if you have somebody in your home that's got a chronic illness and they need constant care and you're always vigilant for hearing, you know, for them calling your name, or you've got young kids that are constantly coming after you, so you're just like trying to tend to all the things, it's really difficult to just breathe and arrive, right? Or if you've got a partner who is like really grouchy when they get home, so you're kind of walking on eggshells. So just really, really investigating, where do I just really feel like I can arrive for just a few moments and like, oh, sigh, where things feel more connected, where I can look around, I'm not feeling as tense. It's going to be different for each of us and also for how long we feel safe. You know, for some of us, we might be a place and we feel safe enough as long as we're there. For others, it might be 10, 15 minutes here or there. I'm able to just kind of arrive, breathe, feel really present. And all of that's okay. It's not right or wrong. It's just for you. What does safety feel like? And who and where are you most likely to be able to experience that sense of safety so that you can then start connecting with joy and pleasure and aliveness and connection?
Okay. You even saying these words, be present and arrive and breathe. I'm like, oh, it's just, I'm like, what, Dawn?
It's more of that.
Yeah. It's funny how the brain really just likes to hear it, you know, yes. How it works.
Yeah.
Dawn, if someone has a history of sexual trauma, do you believe that they can reclaim their sexual health?
Yeah. This is a personal experience for me and for many of my clients. And I want to say the answer is definitely yes. Okay. The complicated part of that, and this is something that I had to mourn for quite a long time. I know I'm not alone. This is kind of the journey for a lot of people who have experienced sexual violence. Is so often after something happens, we want to go back to who we were before.
Mm.
And that is a trap that can really keep us unable to move forward. Because, of course, we can't go back. We can't undo. We can't time travel, at least not yet. And so one of the things that I've learned that can be really difficult but so important is that once some kind of trauma happens, whether it's a sexual trauma or some other kind of trauma, being able to find support and to begin orienting from what is true now. I might not like that I get really triggered in certain circumstances. I might not like or want to feel unsafe when I see strange men walking down the street towards me. I might not like or want those things, but the fact of the matter is they're simply true. That does happen. So if that's true, then what do I need to tend to myself, to give myself permission around? How can I begin understanding what it means to live in the body or in the world in this body now? And so that can be really tough for a lot of people following sexual trauma or sexual violence, is we don't want it to be true, but once we start doing some supported work, usually we get to a place where we realize, this is who I am now. I am in a body that's had this trauma. It might be different. So how can I start treating it with care, getting curious about what I need, and really slowing down? You know, the things that used to feel really good to us might not feel as good for a while or ever again, but there's other things that feel good. So can we start exploring those? The wonderful news is there's so many resources and support groups. And I've worked with tons of people over the years who have felt really constricted, you know, around sex, feeling like it's something that's really scary, that's really difficult. It's really easy to become triggered. And when we really start, one, slowing things down and really validating what is true for me, this is hard. This doesn't feel good like I want it to. And grieving that, then we can also start getting curious about, so what would feel good? And what speed do you enjoy? And mapping new ways forward where new stories, new pathways, new connections begin to be revealed. And that really helps to just increase our capacity for holding the hard things that have happened, and that there's so much possibility for wonderful things still ahead of us. And most importantly, not trying to do all of that alone. You know, whether it's survivor support groups, trusted friends and family, therapists, coaches, people you trust, being able to just be in the hard things with others and to have that witnessed and validated and not rushing is so, so, so important.
I notice in your more recent posts on Facebook and Instagram that there's quite a bit around that process for you, where you used to try to speed it up. You're going to this person and doing body work and doing that work and really hoping that it would just move it along very quickly.
Yep.
And now you've come to a place, it looks like from the posts, that are more about pacing yourself. Is that what you mean? So this is something that, that you have experienced, trying to speed it up versus pacing yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because whether it's sexual violence or just wanting to be a better person, we live in a culture that encourages us to always be working on ourselves and to always be working on perfection. You know, can I be more, you know, mentally acute? Can I do this work faster? Can I optimize? Can I do all these things? And we turn our healing into a project often. And part of that is because, you know, trauma does make it hard to be in the body. And so we feel so uncomfortable with that. We want it to go away as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, what I've learned firsthand and also what I've learned from all of the trainings that I've done is that the faster we go, the slower the healing is.
Oh, well said.
Right. And the faster we go, the slower the healing is. Yeah. And so slow is fast. That's something my therapist said to me many times over the years, is slow is fast. And so instead of turning it into, well, if I do all these different workshops and I work with all these different people and I'll just get on the other side of this, those are all ways of just escaping the body, of not ever really having to arrive and feel. Because if I'm doing, thinking, trying, I'm never just really arriving here and being in this messy, uncomfortable, imperfect place. But that's exactly what's needed, is to be here and to feel. And again, not do it alone, but when we can just really start slowing things down and finding little ways to experience our life, finding ways to connect with our agency and our autonomy and not feeling rushed. And this can be a hard one for partners. Mm. If we're partnered, often our partners want us to go faster. And that needs to be a pretty hard boundary, you know, of like, nope, we're not rushing this. This is important. I matter. Mm-hmm. But when we can really slow down and feel and stretch and arrive, that's where the healing really happens, as uncomfortable as that is.
I like it. This has deepened my understanding of it. But before delving into this, I would always try to make a point with clients to not do any false advertising about a skill set or a tool. You know, like you can use this and it may be a little bit better than not doing it. But as a reminder, it's not transformative. Every little bit matters, but it's not transformative. And I think that's such an important piece just so people don't have the expectation, you know, that, oh, I'm going to do this and it's going to be gone, because it's just not realistic.
Yeah. Right. Right. The one size fits all is seductive for a reason. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we want the magic bullet. We want the easy solution. And this is something that's true around our trauma and also around sex, right? We want that listicle of how to give the perfect hand job or how to do, you know, in three steps, how to always end an orgasm, because we don't want to feel uncomfortable. We don't want to feel unsure. We don't want to be in that kind of messy, I'm not quite sure space. We're trying to escape actually what it is to kind of be human, which is imperfectly messily here. And so whether it's our trauma or it's sex or even our diets, right? Mm-hmm, anything promising, this is the way, this will totally transform you, follow these five steps, we guarantee you, it will work for some people. But it's mostly selling us on wanting to escape the discomfort, right? Mm-hmm. We want to believe there's one answer because that feeds into our desire for control and safety.
Sure.
And so whether it's the trauma, the food, the sex, you know, the truth is, in my experience, the really good stuff, the yummy stuff, the meaningful stuff, the healing happens inside of that messy ambiguity, those liminal spaces, those let me try this and see how it works for me's, rather than if I do this, it's always going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes me think, too, it ties in so nicely of one of your more recent blogs on urgency, mm-hmm. our sense of urgency. And yes. And I had to take a step back there because I'm definitely have had people-pleasing tendencies and a tendency mm-hmm. to be very responsive to the emails, you know, and the sense of urgency. And ever since reading the blog, awareness gives you a choice, right? I've been slowing down a little bit.
Right. Yeah, that's the important thing. A little bit.
A little bit.
Just little things here and there. Because, you know, another thing that we do to ourselves that really in the end doesn't help us. I know I'm not alone in this one, but it's like, you know, you go to a meditation retreat and you're feeling good at it and you're like, I'm going to meditate every day for an hour. For most of us, that is wildly unrealistic, but we're riding that high. And so we tell ourselves, I'm going to stick to this diet. I'm going to do the meditation, whatever it is. And we kind of set ourselves up for these falls that hurt. And then, you know, we feel ashamed or we feel guilty or whatever it is. And so when it comes to same thing, breaking up with urgency, you know, it's so tempting to be like, well, I'm just going to stop.
Right.
Responding to emails after 7, or I'm going to not work at all on weekends.
Right.
And instead, I like to invite people, can we just arrive for a few seconds and just experience something lovely? Can we just catch ourselves when we're doing it and just be like, huh, oh, there's me wanting to rush. Mm-hmm. There's me wanting to do the fast thing. And then I might go right on with it. But the more we just can bring in that awareness, because sometimes choosing urgency is the best thing for us. It will really free up some time. But when I'm doing it without choosing it, that's where it becomes really complicated. And it's the same with all these other things we've been talking about, right? Am I actually choosing this for myself, or am I playing out scripts? Am I playing out habits? Am I trying not to be uncomfortable? So I'm rushing all those things.
Love it. And I love breaking up with urgency.
Yes.
Waking up with urgency. I love it.
Break up with urgency. Heck yes. If more of us could do that.
Oh, ooh, yes. It's a slow break.
Yes.
So, Dawn, what are your thoughts about counterfeit pleasure versus, I don't know what the opposite would be, authentic pleasure?
Yeah. Yeah, I love that word counterfeit. I've been saying like performative pleasure versus embodied pleasure, but I kind of like that counterfeit pleasure too.
Oh, but I like that. Another way could be performative pleasure versus what was the other one?
Embodied
pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, what are your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm.
How would you be able to discern?
Yeah. So in my experience, a lot of the ways that we experience pleasure is rather performative, or as you're saying, counterfeit. And that's usually because it's for others. It kind of ties to that self-objectification, right? Where instead of actually experiencing the thing, I'm taking pictures of the thing to share on social media to get the likes or to get the comments. Maybe I'm saying yes to something because I think it's going to make the person I'm with feel excited or happy or think that I'm really cool and sexy, even if I'm not really actually super enjoying it. There's like a Las Vegas-y quality to it often. You know, counterfeit pleasure is kind of flashy and for others. There's a performance to it. And there's often not a lot of choice. And part of the reason we do those kinds of pleasure is because it's really vulnerable to actually arrive in our bodies and to begin feeling, and especially to be witnessed by someone when we are totally unguarded and just experiencing a moment. That is quite different. And if someone rejects us in that place, that is a really raw rejection. And so often we are trying to kind of buffer ourselves against feeling rejected in our most vulnerable places by just doing a little version of it or putting a little kind of spin on it for others, just so that we're not experiencing that vulnerable, that like, oh God, it's so vulnerable. And also so we aren't getting hurt. You know, there's a self-protective mechanism to that. But embodied pleasure really, the thing about pleasure is it only ever exists in the present moment.
But can it be used as escapism?
It can be.
Or is that, I guess that could be healthy or not, depending on the person.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to that choice of, do I feel like I've got some choice? Like, I had a hard day. I was stressed all day. And you know what? All that I want is just some time to not have to make any decisions. And so I'm just going to put the Netflix on. And really, that is what would feel good for me right now versus I'm just doing this because I need to fill the void. I can't tolerate the silence. I can't be with myself. I don't know what else I can do. Right. So do I really feel like there's some choice? Sometimes the escapism is great. Sometimes it's really self-protective. Sometimes it's numbing, right? We're just trying to not feel a thing. And so we it's up to us to decide, is this helping me get through a hard thing or is this hurting me and keeping me from my life and what I really want?
Oh, okay.
And I think, you know, when it comes to pleasure is it really asks us to feel. And that's been one of the hardest things for people, especially people who come through like my pleasure courses. We're really good. And again, this is not our fault. Many of us were raised in households where when we were children, our anger wasn't welcome. When we were punished for behaving in certain ways or told not to cry, it's not that bad. That trained us that certain emotions bring people closer and certain emotions push people away. And as we grow up, we also see that in the workplace, only certain emotions are welcome. If you display other emotions, you're too much, you're unprofessional, right? And so all of this ties to pleasure because when we really arrive in our body and start asking, what is it that I want? What is it that I need? What am I feeling? We begin feeling. And we can't cut ourselves off from certain emotions without cutting ourselves off from all emotions in some way. And when we begin feeling more deeply towards our pleasure, feeling more joy, feeling more yes, we're also going to be then opening ourselves up to feeling more grief, feeling more sadness, feeling more heartbreak for all the times we abandon ourselves, for all the times we downplayed our needs. And so a pleasure practice really is also a grief practice, because we're feeling more and we're beginning to understand all the times that we didn't actually prioritize our needs. And so it makes sense that, you know, some of us aren't quite ready to go there. So we're just going to kind of keep performing our pleasure. But for people really wanting to deepen, you know, that embodied pleasure opens us up to so much more. But that also means it opens us up to so much more.
Is that why it can be difficult to have sex for the heck of it? Do you see what I'm saying there? For some.
Yeah.
Because some people can have sex for the heck of it.
Yep.
And not get attached. And that can be, well, I don't know. You're the expert. I'm assuming that can be a healthy thing.
Absolutely.
Other people may think they can have sex for the heck of it, and it might feel good in the moment, but maybe not after.
Yeah, so that's another really great place for investigating, is this what I really want? And it really makes me think of, there's this beautiful quote from Betty Martin, who wrote a book called The Art of Receiving and Giving. Highly recommend it for everybody. But I won't get the quote just right. But basically what Betty says is, if touch always leads to sex and sex always leads to orgasm, then we begin to believe that touch is tied to a very particular goal. And it means that touch becomes dangerous, because we believe the only way that we can experience touch is when it leads to sex, instead of touch being a source of pleasure, connection, soothing, restoration. You know, it's just about this one thing. And that's a pretty important point, I think, when we're talking about like casual sex, is, am I doing this because it just would feel really good? I'm really connected to my power. There's something about this person. It would be really fun to have this physical experience with them. And I'm really, truly choosing it for me. I feel like I can say no. I can have really healthy boundaries, articulate what I need, leave if what's happening isn't working for me. Or am I choosing this because I'm desperate for connection? I'm desperate to feel seen. I need some type of validation. And this happens to be how I get it met. Again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but knowing why we're choosing something helps to keep us more connected to our bodies, right? Because are we abandoning ourselves because we don't realize we have other choices? Maybe that's just what we have to do right now to survive what our lives are. But if we have more choice, maybe there are more ways that I can feel seen and valued, appreciated, cared for. If I realize I've got 10 ways to get all those needs met, and I still choose the casual sex because that one is what's going to fulfill the need right now, great. But if I don't have those other choices and I'm choosing it because I feel like I have to, or that's how I define my worth, that may be a place where maybe there's an opportunity for a little investigation, some support to just increase options.
I see. I love that. I love the idea that, you know, it may be experiential. So you may think like, I can do it for the heck of it and not do much of an investigation and realize like, oh, I actually had expectation there that I didn't even know about. Note to self. To self.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I like that. We both do a lot of work around body image. And I'll speak for myself. I witness clients' journey in their changing bodies as somebody who treats eating disorders. And so typically working with a lot of changing bodies, people processing that. There can be a lot of resistance around changing bodies. And I think that's putting it mildly, as we both know. Yeah. What works best for helping people around their changing bodies?
Ooh. It's a tough one, and for good reason, right? Mm-hmm. We do live in a culture and a society that has a very, very clear hierarchy of bodies. Who is worthy of care, respect, desirability, and who is seen as disposable, you know, unworthy, even subhuman. And we're talking like disability, aging, body size, all kinds of different things, skin color. I mean, you name it. So there's definitely a hierarchy, and we are all aware of that hierarchy, whether we like it or not, we know it exists. And so it makes sense that when our bodies change, whether it's that they're getting bigger or we're losing an ability because of illness or age, that there's a mourning process in that. Because we realize that we will be losing access to certain spaces and certain people and certain resources. And so that is something for us to grieve, for us to not like, for us to even be enraged by, which is a great place for some activism. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, getting involved in activism can really help direct the rage in the right direction rather than at self and body. Let's put it out at the systems, right?
Ooh, well said.
And then the other thing that I found is so often people don't realize that there's all kinds of people out in the world living amazing lives in fat bodies, in super fat bodies, in disabled bodies, in aging bodies, but they're not as visible, right? Social media specifically hides certain kinds of bodies from our feeds. So it's harder to find them. We have to intentionally seek them out. Certainly pop culture is not, you know, featuring a lot of different types of bodies. So again, that hierarchy is coming into play. And so what I've found helps people is, one, validating those feelings. Like they're real, because it does suck that there is a hierarchy of bodies. You know, like, I don't want to deny somebody being sad about that, that they're going to go into places where maybe the chairs don't fit them anymore. Mm-hmm. Like it sucks. It shouldn't be that way, but it is. And can we start connecting with all of these incredible people that are doing work in the world, that are on social media, that are making their own videos, that are leading these incredible lives, and they're in all kinds of different bodies? That really helped me early in my journey when I started moving towards like body acceptance and moving away from my disordered eating. Was I got connected with Jess Baker, who's the Militant Baker. And then she led me to all of these other people who were so rad. They had such cool fashion sense. They were saying these really radical things that I never thought could have applied to me. And the more I got connected with others, the more I realized, like, wow, these people are amazing and funny and smart. I mean, we don't see that anywhere in the world for the most part. And so maybe I can exist in my body and be happy and loved and cared for. You know, it gave me a little bit more courage to see what was possible. So I think for people that are in bodies that are changing, it's really important to intentionally start seeking out and curating media, social media, friends, community that welcome a wide range of bodies instead of just kind of your dominant culture, typical, you know, thin fetishism spaces that really only value certain kinds of bodies and ages and abilities. And so I think that that helps validation, activism, and getting connected with community and people who are in bodies like yours doing really rad things in the world, so that you see that it's not, you know, I don't have to go be alone in a dark corner. I can be out in the world surrounded by amazing people. It might just be different people.
And I love it must have been another blog of yours that I read. I've been busy reading blogs of yours where you talked about where our preferences for certain bodies come from. And I thought it was such a cool angle to start with something we can all relate to, like food. So it sounds like in the blog, it sounds like you're Norwegian and there's a certain kind of food. My name is Norwegian, I guess, like 150-year-old woman's name is Signa, but whatever. But you talked about how there are certain foods that just sound disgusting to you, but you also haven't had the exposure.
Exactly.
And so maybe they wouldn't be.
Right. Exactly.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it's just like because there are studies showing, you know, you can look them up. There's multiples of them. But there's studies showing that if you ask a group of people to rate their body and then you expose them to like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes of images of people in a wide range of bodies, including lots of bigger bodies, looking happy and, you know, being with friends, and then ask them to rate their body again on the other side of that, the scores go up.
Wow.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's because we're being exposed to look at these people being happy and connected, and they're not on a scale with the sad faces, you know, like we often see in all those stock images of fat folks. And so the exposure piece of what is just normal becomes different.
I like how that actually takes the idea of curating your feed a little further. Because that's actually explaining, well, here's an example of how it actually does that. I've never heard that before. I love that. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're so welcome. So, you know, whether it's a dish that some people grow up with and it's normal for them, but for us, we're like, that's what you're having for breakfast?
I don't want that dish either. Yeah, I don't want that gelatinous. Yeah. I don't even know the term. I don't. Yeah. But I was like, ooh, that, how could I ever like that? But you took it further. I'm like, wait, I just haven't had the exposure.
Exactly. From the youngest of
culture, ages. That might be my favorite food. I'm squinting.
Exactly.
Yeah. It makes me squeamish, but it's possible. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Dawn, so we have a Therapy Rocks listener that wrote in.
Yay.
And I got a question that I'm excited to hear the answer to. The listener wants to know, what is your best tip for a couple that has different libidos?
Here's the thing that I always start with.
Okay.
Basically, anyone who's in an intimate sexual relationship with another person long enough, this will just happen.
Okay.
No two human beings on the face of the planet have the exact same libidos because we're all living in different bodies with different experiences and different lives. And so this is normal. This is normal. This is just what it means to be in relationship with other humans past that new relationship energy stage, right? Mm-hmm. So early in a relationship, when we're obsessed with each other, it's because our brains are flooded with chemicals and it's known as new relationship energy. So that tends to feel a little bit more like, oh, we're on the same page, but that's also not very real to life. So differing libidos, it's just kind of how it is. That's the first thing I want to put out there. It's not a you thing or a different partner thing. It's just pretty, pretty normal. The other place that I like to start is normalizing for people. The person with the lower libido is not broken. They do not need to fix something. They are not the ones that are wrong and need to increase their libido. Same thing, the people with the higher libido, nothing wrong with you. You don't need to lower it. You don't need to do anything different. They just are what they are. And when we can come from a place of neither one of us is broken or wrong, because unfortunately, there is definitely, especially in like the scientific literature, there is a heavy emphasis on the person with the lower libido needs to be fixed. Mm. And it's astounding. If you look at the literature on libido, you know, in any like academic forum and you search that up, all of the articles, every single one of them is going to be about what do we do to fix the low libido person, which is BS. Part of that is just like patriarchy and sexism. But it's important to know our libidos are just what they are for good reason. Now, if we're talking about a heterosexual couple, and perhaps the lower libido person is a woman and the higher libido person is a man, this is, tends to be a little bit more common, but it's not unusual for them to be the opposite. But it's really important for us to also really think about, is part of the reason for the low libido because of caretaking? emotional labor, mental load. It's really difficult to feel sexy if you are kind of parenting your partner. And we see this play out in a lot of heterosexual relationships. You know, we call it the mother load for a reason, that often in heterosexual relationships, especially, the woman is the person who is in the back of her mind, knows what groceries need to be had, what the schedule is for the family, who the doctor is for the kids, when we need to take the car, you know, to pick somebody up from the airport, right? So all of those things are taking up space. And when those things are really unequal, you're having to ask your partner to do things constantly rather than them just showing up as an adult and doing them without being asked. That really takes a toll. It's hard to connect with our erotic energy when so much of our energy is holding things together and it's very unequal, right? It's hard to feel sexy when, you know, there's 50 things that have to get done and it's all on you. And so it's just really important to begin kind of investigating, right? What is that like? Do I feel burdened? Is there low-level resentment? That might be a place where if something's shifted, there would be more room to just feel a little bit more spacious, to be a little more present, connecting with my pleasure. So again, it's not that the low libido person is wrong, but sometimes there are very good reasons for having a lower libido because all that energy is going into other things.
So those would be some obstacles to getting access to libido.
Right.
I'm thinking this, I didn't think this before, but now I'm wondering, like, what is libido? I get that there may be some obstacles to getting access to that energy.
Yeah.
But let's pretend for a minute that there aren't. What is libido at a more basic level?
Yeah. So I love this question. So for a long time, the past couple of years, there's been a running model called the dual control model of sexual desire. And basically, it talks about whether you're a spontaneous or a responsive libido person. Now, more recently, we're really beginning to realize basically everybody is responsive desire in that some stimuli happens and then we start feeling aroused. But it's just that people who maybe have spontaneous libido have lots of things that turn them on that are very easily available. And so it happens really fast. Versus for some of us, we need a lot of things to really kind of be happening before we start connecting with that energy.
I see.
Right. And so the way that sex educator and researcher Emily Nagoski describes it is she says that responsive desire is like, you know, you get invited to go to a party by your friends. And in the moment, you're like, that sounds great. I totally want to go. But then Friday night rolls around. You're sitting at home, no pants on. You got your favorite movie in. And your friends are like, are you coming out? And you're like, oh, I have to put pants on. And you kind of don't really want to, but you kind of know you'll have a good time if you get there. So you put your pants on, you get ready, you go to the party. And once you're there, you have a fantastic time.
Such a good example. We can all relate to that.
Yes. So responsive desire is a little bit like that, where you may not feel up for it, but you're still kind of choosing it. You're like, well, you know, okay, I'll give it a try. It'll make my partner happy, or it might feel good once we get started. And then once the touching and the kissing and the things start happening, if you start becoming aroused after a little while and then you're like, oh, okay, this is feeling good, let's keep going. That's responsive desire.
So some people are more spontaneous. Spontaneous. What's the term though? Spontaneous.
Yeah. Spontaneous versus responsive.
Spontaneous versus responsive libidos. And can that be genetic?
It could be. I'm not going to say that it's not, but I do think that it's more contextual.
I see.
Right. Context matters. Because often
context
what happens
matters. Okay.
You might have had this happen where, like, in your everyday life, you're kind of like, I mean, like, I wish I had time to feel energetic about sex, but I'm running a business and taking care of my family. I have money worries. But then you go on vacation
I see.
Right. And yes. You're like, oh, yes, let's like, let's be naked. Let's have sex. Let's like just lounge around. And
I see.
The context that's changed. You haven't changed, but the context has.
A lot without all the layers, you might be spontaneous.
Right. Exactly. Right. So the context is really, really important. What is the context? And then the other thing that's really important, and a lot of researchers lately have been focusing on this, and I'm so happy about it, is this sex worth having?
Mm.
Right. Why would I be excited about sex if I'm just kind of tolerating it? It's okay-ish. But when I try to ask for something different, my partner doesn't really hear. Maybe I get rushed. Maybe it's always like as soon as I start kissing, then we go to mouths and then immediately we go to intercourse. And intercourse hasn't been feeling that great for me lately, you know, or whatever it is. So is the sex worth having? And some researchers have developed a new program that's 16 weeks for couples who are in a situation where they have differing libidos. And then they move them through the 16-week program of teaching them how to have optimal erotic experiences, which requires like really slowing down, decentering intercourse, getting really creative, really openly communicating. And they find that on the other side of those 16 weeks, they're having much better sex and they're so much happier about the sex that they're having that their differing libidos don't matter anymore.
Oh my gosh. This yeah. just comes full circle, ties in everything you were talking about before, about accessing pleasure.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I was thinking, well, to access that kind of pleasure, you'd also have to feel so safe with your partner and be able to communicate mm-hmm. all these things. I mean, so many layers. And then here it is. It just comes full circle.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked it. I was afraid at first to say, like, aren't I supposed to know what a libido actually is?
No.
I'm like, no, yeah. not really, sort of, on the surface, but not
right.
not like that. Oh, yeah. That's very cool. Thank you, Dawn.
Oh, you're so welcome.
So, Dawn, thank you for the work you do, helping people heal their relationship with their body and food through pleasure. And I think it's so interesting because most of us think of healing as this thing that has to be so difficult and painful. Mm. And it's just such a nice reminder to hear that it can be fun and enjoyable and imperfect.
Yes.
It's just so, nice to be. We need those reminders. And I'm just in such awe of the work that you do. And I always have been. So thank you for taking the time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. I really appreciate
fun.
It.
I love
so
it.
Fun.
Oh my gosh, I can talk for hours with you.
I know.
Oh gosh. Okay. Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.